From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, billions of dollars of federal stimulus money will soon be unleashed, and Sacramento leaders have a wish list of local projects they think should qualify. Also, a local poet wraps up a decades-long labor of love, an 8-volume translation of the poems of Pablo Neruda. But first, one of the greatest scientists in history was born 200 years ago this week, Charles Darwin, the English naturalist who developed the theory of natural selection. This year is also the 150th anniversary of Darwin's greatest work, The Origin of Species. That's the book in which he first discussed his arguments for natural selection. We're going to discuss Charles Darwin and the impact that he and his theories have had on science with a variety of experts. We're going to start with Michael Shermer, who's a publisher of Skeptic magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, an adjunct professor at Claremont Graduate University, and the author of numerous science books, including Why Darwin Matters. We're speaking with him because he was in Sacramento yesterday talking about the legacy of Charles Darwin. Michael Shermer, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
I think that the person in the street, so to speak, probably credits Darwin with, quote-unquote, inventing evolution. What exactly did he discover and not discover?
Right. Well, there were a number of different evolutionary theories floating around before Darwin's time and through his childhood and growing up and so forth. And what Darwin did that was different was to actually give it a mechanism. When people often want to know, since he figured it out in the late 1830s and early 1840s, why it took him 20 years to get around to publishing it. And the answer was because other people had published popular works on evolution, most notably Vestiges of Creation by Anonymous, a guy named Robert Chambers, that were severely panned by the scientific critics. And Darwin's mentors told him, see, don't do that. Hang on to your theory and build a reputation as a world-class scientist with very specific technical works. He did a 3-volume monograph on barnacles, for example. And once you've established yourself as, you know, a world-class scientist, then you can, you know, later kind of speculate about the big picture. So that's what he was doing. He had planned a multi-volume book on natural selection he got a letter in June of 1858 from Alfred Russel Wallace on the other side of the world in the Malay Archipelago. And Alfred Russel Wallace was a younger naturalist, 13 years younger than Darwin, and friends of Darwin, and he kind of looked up to Darwin. And Wallace had hatched this idea of basically natural selection, and he didn't know who else to send his sort of incipient ideas to, so he mailed it off to Darwin. So Darwin gets this letter and this essay, and it's like, as he said, the subtitles of the paper are like the same titles of the chapters in my book. And he felt very distressed because, you know, he didn't want to lose priority. Of course, he'd been working on it for decades. But on the other hand, you know, he wanted to do what the gentlemanly thing to do was, which was then to turn it over to a couple of other scientists who then presented both ideas at the Linnaean Society on July 1st, mm-hmm. 1858. So that's how that came about.
For people at that time who accepted that evolution was the mechanism that created life on Earth and, you know, managed the development of life on Earth, how did people explain it at that time, evolution, without natural selection being an accepted theory? What was the mechanism that allowed evolution to happen?
Right. Well, before Darwin, you can find passages in pre-Darwinian authors, naturalists, philosophers, who talk about something that sounds like natural selection. What they're actually describing is the weeding out or eliminating varieties that are not in the mainstream of the kind, the essence of the species. So it's really Aristotelian and Ptolemaic essentialism. It's the idea that there is a core essence of a being. A dog, you know, has fur and curly tail and floppy ears, and it barks. You know, that's a dog. It's not a cat. It's not becoming a cat. And yes, okay, there are some dogs that look like little rats, and there's some dogs that look like small horses and all that. But those are just varieties. They're not becoming anything. They're just varieties who, if they become too different, they'll just die out. So nature selects against those that are too deviant from the fixed kind. That's what the prevailing theory was before Darwin. What Darwin did was to turn that idea upside down, stand it on its head, and said, no, actually what's being selected for are certain characteristics that help the species survive to help the offspring get into the next generation. And what we would today would say the genes into the next generation. Of course, Darwin didn't know anything about genes. But so that was what was unique to Darwin. He actually took a mechanism that naturalists were kind of aware of and turned it into a mechanism for change, not for keeping species the same, but for actually making them different, and that overturned 2,000 years of this essentialism, and that's what today we would call intelligent design. That is what he was overturning. He had read a book called Natural Theology by a guy named William Paley, who first gave us the watchmaker argument in 1804. You stumble across a watch when you're out in the woods somewhere, you're not going to think that's like the rock sitting next to it that just naturally belongs here. It looks designed. That was the original design argument. And what Darwin was saying was that, in fact, no, given enough time, those simple rocks can actually turn into something else. Not rocks, but simple forms can become more complex through this process of natural selection.
Michael Shermer, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, monthly columnist for Scientific American. We're talking about the life, the science, the legacy of Charles Darwin. He was born 200 years ago this Thursday. In our studio is Jim Griesemer, who's a philosophy professor and chair of the department at UC Davis. He, among other things, teaches an undergraduate class on Darwin, the man, his life, the development of his ideas. Jim, welcome to Insight.
Glad to be here.
What kind of person was Charles Darwin? If we'd met him, would we have naturally thought, wow, this is a revolutionary guy, a great scientist?
Well, when he was growing up, he was considered by his family rather ordinary. He was always curious. He enjoyed the outdoors, but he was a second son. He wasn't the star performer of the family.
What kind of life did he see for himself when he was young?
His life was it changed over time. So he grew up. His mother died when he was eight. His father was rather domineering. His father was a very well-to-do physician. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was an even better-known physician. And his father decided for him that he would have a career in medicine like he did and packed him off to Edinburgh University to study medicine. He didn't do very well as a medical student. He hated the hours. He didn't like listening to lectures about the properties of rhubarb before breakfast, and he couldn't stand the sight of blood. So he wasn't cut out for medicine. After 2 years at Edinburgh, he gave up.
So what was he going to do next?
Father decided, as many prominent did in that time, to choose the second best career for the wayward son, and that was divinity. A country parish priesthood. And Charles was sent to Cambridge University, which is one of the two Anglican universities at the time, to study divinity and hopefully make something of himself.
It's a little ironic that he was on a career to being a member of the clergy when his life's work ultimately undermined divine rationale for the way of the universe.
Even more than just that, because his father and grandfather were freethinkers, you might call them secular humanists today, and on his mother's side, they were Unitarians. The Anglican faith was Trinitarian. Both sides of his family were really dissenters, so they didn't follow the standard line of the Anglican Church, but Cambridge was an Anglican university, so he would have had to subscribe to articles of religion in order to gain his degree that were outside the tradition of the family.
Well, how did Charles Darwin go from studying religion, divinity at Cambridge University to being on a boat off South America studying creatures?
Well, one of the key influences on him while he was at Cambridge was a professor of botany, John Henslow. And Henslow, like Charles, grew up with an interest both in chemistry and also in the natural world. And Henslow ran a little Friday evening event for students, undergraduate students, and Charles fell in with the professor of botany. He enjoyed being outdoors. Eventually, Henslow became his tutor in math and in divinity studies in order to get him through his exams for his degree. And Charles, I think, was the sort of person who really took to mentors. And Henslow showed him that it was possible to imagine a life as a parish priest, but one who was not particularly motivated by the church, but rather by a comfortable life, a way of being in nature. And then he had was given this incredible opportunity, because he was raised as a gentleman, to serve as the unpaid naturalist on a voyage, the Beagle,
which went away for several years, went around South America, stopped at the Galapagos Islands, and went on shore to various parts of South America. And that's where he made his key observations.
Captain Fitzroy needed a gentleman to be a companion on the voyage. Fitzroy feared somewhat for his own sanity. He had had members of his family go insane, and he wanted somebody of his class in order to talk to on the boat. The person he had in mind dropped out. Charles was invited as a budding naturalist. Even though they were of different political persuasions, Fitzroy was an evangelical Tory, and Darwin was a Whig, that is, a liberal of the time. And so even though they were divided by these political and religious views, being a gentleman and having manners won out, and Charles got the opportunity, five years.
We're talking about Charles Darwin. This week is his 200th anniversary of his birth. Jim Griesemer is a philosophy professor at UC Davis. And Michael Shermer on the phone. What a strange turn of events that this young man who didn't really know where he was going in life chose religion as a comfortable occupation, but then somehow found himself on a boat off of South America and making these groundbreaking discoveries.
Yeah, the other aspect of it was that in Darwin's early training at Edinburgh, he was an undergraduate there, there was a budding movement called natural theology in which God's a very difficult thing to study. I mean, you know, where is he? How do you measure him? And so on. But you can study his works. So there was natural theology was kind of the correlation between God's words in the Bible and God's works, nature. And that legitimized through the 17th and 18th century the study of nature as a way of understanding the divinity's actions in this world. And so, in a way, for Darwin, it was kind of an excuse to go outdoors and collect stuff and say, hey, look, I'm doing natural theology. And yet again, a way to appease his father, who was mildly disappointed that he didn't want to be a, you know, a physician or a lawyer. And so at least with theology, he could do natural theology and then go outdoors. So some of that was there, and of course he took that and ran with it and created a whole new science there. But I think as a creative thinker, Darwin as a personality had the right blend of confidence, self-confidence, and yet not too locked into his preconceived notions such that he would write hundreds, thousands of people in his lifetime looking for feedback. And if you look at chapter 6 in The Origin of Species, it's called Problems on Theory, he actually anticipated what the critics would say because for decades he had been corresponding with scientists, giving them his thoughts on nature and getting their critical feedback such that by the time he went to print with it, he had already heard all the criticisms there could be mustered against it. So that's a very socially intelligent, emotionally intelligent thing to do. So in addition to being that, Darwin, in addition to being a creative scientist, he was also pretty savvy that way.
Let's talk a bit about more about the actual science of Charles Darwin. In our studio, Gerard Vermeij, geology professor at UC Davis. His specialties include marine ecology and paleoecology. Gerard Vermeij, welcome back to Insight.
Very nice to be here, Jeffrey.
Even the greatest scientists, it seems to me, as the years, the decades, the centuries go by, their groundbreaking findings are chipped away and replaced by more correct science, shall we say. How does the science of Charles Darwin stand up today, 150 years after the publication of his most famous book?
I can think of very few biologists whose work stands up better than Charles Darwin's. Sure, we've added vast amounts of new information about genetics, about paleontology, almost every other branch of biology imaginable, but his basic ideas proved to be right. Even his inferences about things as simple as climbing plants and insectivorous plants about human origins have proved to stand the test of time. So he had remarkably good insight, very good observer he was. He was a fastidious reader. He really got things mostly right, I would say.
As a professional scientist yourself, what does that say to you about Charles Darwin? Because when he joined the crew of the Beagle, he was really a gentleman, an amateur scientist.
And he was also the age of a beginning graduate student. He was just 22, yes. I think, when he went on the Beagle. I think what it said, and what there was abundant evidence for earlier, is that he was an extremely good observer, one with a very broad cast of mind. So, for example, when he came to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and he was for the first time in his life in a rainforest, what struck him, as reported by him in the Voyage of the Beagle, was how strong the struggle for life seemed to him. By walking around in that forest, he saw organisms fighting and brightly colored, and it was very obvious it was a huge struggle for life. I think that impressed him greatly.
Was there anything significant scientifically that Darwin got wrong?
Oh, Darwin, I'm sure, got something wrong. I have to say I can't think of anything right offhand that he got wrong in a major way. I'm sure there were some, I know there was some trivial thing or another.
Yes. Michael Shermer?
Yeah, he didn't know about genetics, so he speculated about the gemmules, what we would call sperm cells, mixing in some odd way and somehow passing on characteristics. But he, was, of course, clueless, so he was just sort of stumbling around in the dark of the question is, what's the next level down of mechanism, the black box, what's inside that black box? And he didn't know. No one knew until Crick and Watson finally cracked it in 1953, but
1953, yeah.
Nor did he know anything, of course, about molecular biology, but even I would still argue that even his inheritance stories were not really fundamentally wrong. He understood enough about domestication and the inheritance of traits that he didn't stumble too badly there, actually, given his total ignorance of genetics.
Jim Griesemer?
Yeah, right.
Certainly the model of pangenesis, that the modifications of the cells of the body through these gemmules that Michael was talking about flowing back into the germ cells, we don't believe that now. It is generally recognized that Darwin's pangenesis model was quite stimulating to theorists after that, but the model was definitely wrong. One of the early events in his geology after he got back from the Beagle voyage turned out to be wrong, too. He had an explanation for some lines of bedding in Scotland in the so-called parallel roads of Glen Roy. And one of the reasons that was an interesting failure, Darwin suggested, following the geologist Charles Lyell, that this was another case of land being lifted up, elevated out of the sea. But Louis Agassiz, a famous biologist of the time, argued that instead a glacier had dammed up the end of the valley and that it was draining lake water instead. This was an important failure to Darwin because it made him realize that his more speculative moments might actually lead to falsehood and that he should be more cautious about some of his speculative work.
It's my understanding that Darwin became well known during his lifetime because of his book The Origin of Species and his other work, but natural selection was only really accepted without significant opposition once the significant discoveries had been made in genetics. Is that correct, Gerard Vermeij?
I would actually say that the basic premise of natural selection was accepted well before that. The arguments that people had against evolution were less about natural selection than they were about how you get complex structures, how you got things like eyes developing. But the principle, I think, was reasonably well established by well before even the rediscovery of Mendel and de Vries and so forth.
Michael Shermer, what about the challenge that natural selection posed to the divine theories of creation? How did Darwin handle whatever controversy and criticism came his way?
Well, by the time The Origin of Species came out, he was already a non-believer. Never called himself an atheist. Agnostic is the term he used. And he was pretty careful about it because his wife was very religious, and they sort of agreed to disagree. And out of love and respect for her, he never spoke out publicly about it. So at the end of his life, people would write him letters and ask him what he was, and he would answer. And so we have those letters, and basically he talks about his role in life was to promote science, not attack religion. It seemed like a waste of time to him to do that. That the public's mind will not be changed easily by going on an offensive against religion, that minds will be opened by promoting science. And I think that's a pretty respectable position to take. So, but what changed his mind? Well, there were a number of things. Most prominently, the death of his daughter, Anne, when she was 10, was sort of the nail in the coffin. It's the problem of evil. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why should innocent children suffer? And, of course, as a naturalist, he had a laundry list of weird things in nature that, why would an intelligent designer do it that way? And especially a benevolent intelligent designer create these, like the ichneumonid wasp, who stings a caterpillar and paralyzes it, and then plants its eggs inside the caterpillar at the tail end, such that the larvae eat the caterpillar, sort of fresh meat there, as they develop, and they eat it from the tail end to the head end to keep it alive, and they eat the brain, well, whatever a brain a caterpillar has, it, at the very end, and then it dies. And what a cruel, disgusting, horrible thing, as he described it, that a devil's chaplain would create. Why would the designer do that? And he had a whole bunch of examples like that. It just seemed ridiculous to think of a benevolent, kind, all-powerful, all-good being that would do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Instead, it looks like what it is, just nature, red in tooth and claw in that respect.
Thank you. Jim Griesmer, any final thoughts from you about Darwin?
Well, I think Girard has said it all. Darwin's views stand the test of time 150 years on. It's still actively engaged by scientists, and we've learned a lot from him.
Yeah, and Gerard Vermeij, is there, this is asking you to speculate a bit, but if Darwin could join us right now, is there anything you think he would go, wow, after 150 years, they still haven't figured that bit out?
You know, I think there would be. I think he would be curious to learn, for example, how much more we can improve crop plants. And he would have been astonished by genetic engineering, of course. But the thing that I find so impressive is that he really was the point of origin of a vast scientific enterprise that has resulted in one of the most powerful theories that humans have ever created, a very, very powerful theory of evolution. And it has been so thoroughly explanatory and predictive that, to me, that is a great accomplishment by him.
Well, thank you all very much, gentlemen. In our studio, Gerard Vermeij, you just heard him, geology professor at UC Davis. Also in our studio, Jim Griesmer, philosophy professor and chair of the department at UC Davis. And on the phone, Michael Shermer. He's publisher of Skeptic magazine, monthly columnist for Scientific American, and much more. Yesterday, he spoke in Sacramento about the legacy of Charles Darwin. And that was our topic in this part of the program. Thursday is the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. This year is also the 150th anniversary of the publication of his book, The Origin of Species. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, billions of dollars of federal stimulus money will soon be unleashed. Sacramento leaders have a wish list of local projects. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. A new book explores the lives of women in post-war Iraq. Tomorrow in Insight, the co-author of What Kind of Liberation? Women and the Occupation of Iraq tells you what's in the book. She speaks in Davis this week. Also, we'll follow up on last week's discussion of possible solutions to the mortgage crisis. Tens of billions of dollars of federal stimulus money will likely be spent soon on infrastructure projects across the country. Sacramento region leaders want to maximize the amount of cash that comes here. Today, they jointly announced and promoted a list of local projects they think should qualify for federal help. Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler was at their big news conference this morning. Let's listen to what a couple of those leaders had to say. We'll start with West Sacramento Mayor Christopher Cabaldon, who says the Sacramento region has a wide variety of projects ready to go quickly.
We didn't invent them just in the last 30 days to try to take advantage of a federal political process. We've been working on these projects in our region for years as part of a long-term strategy to make sure that we meet human needs, that we develop the best quality of life in the country, that we create environmental sustainability, and that we create economic prosperity.
In Congress, representatives in the House of Representatives and U.S. senators are working on separate bills. They've passed separate bills. There's a committee is now trying to come up with a compromise version. In the meantime, Sacramento County Supervisor Susan Peters says she and others want to see a compromise quickly.
I don't think this group particularly has a version that they're in favor of. What they want Congress to do is come to agreement quickly and pass the bill. Here, we're seeing the actual effects on the ground of people not working, and we want the bill to pass. We want the money to flow as directly as possible to local government so we can get these shovel-ready projects moving.
Also at this morning's news conference was Matt Mayhood, President and CEO of the Sacramento Metro Chamber of Commerce. Matt Mayhood, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, thank you.
Is there a long list of projects that the region's leaders would like to see funded?
The Sacramento region has spent significant time and effort, led by the Sacramento Metro Chamber, pulling together nearly 70 organizations, jurisdictions, municipalities to put together a list of projects that are shovel-ready, either shovel-ready in 120 days or even out an entire year throughout the six-county region. So it's a pretty extensive list of projects that we've identified that we want to get completed in the Sacramento region.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
Well, I could, but I will tell you the examples include transportation, flood protection, transit, higher education, water, sewer, the list goes on. There's about 16 different categories of projects when you break it down.
How are these projects currently funded? Are they not able to proceed without federal money?
Many of these projects can't proceed without federal funding. Many of these projects could not proceed without state funding. And in fact, there are some projects on our list that are simply frozen due to the lack of state funding, due to the budget impasse of the state capitol. So they're looking, some of these projects are looking for federal funding to get them going in the future. But many of these projects simply, you know, need a federal match with a local match to get them going.
I realize each project has its own story, but typically, what would happen to these projects if they did not get federal stimulus money?
If they don't get federal stimulus money, they wouldn't happen immediately. What we've tried to do is put all these projects that the Sacramento region has that are either ready 120 days or farther out on a list, try to prioritize them, those that are going to be ready sooner, and get those projects funded. If they don't get funding now, the hope is that at some point through, you know, the appropriation process and local lobbying efforts, we'll get funding, you know, in a future budget cycle.
Did the Obama administration or members of Congress approach you and other regional leaders and say, give us a list of projects so that we get something concrete here? Or did it go the other way around? Did the region's leaders just get together and say, these are the kind of things that we think should be funded soon?
Well, the Sacramento Metro Chamber, we've been in constant contact with our local congressional delegation, in particular Congresswoman Matsui's office, and we are in conversations with the City of Sacramento and the City of West Sacramento and with SACOG, the Sacramento Area Council of Governments. And when we started having these conversations, we decided, you know, we've always done really well as a region when we collaborate and we put our heads together. So that's when the Metro Chamber took it upon itself to call a meeting of regional leadership and start developing this regional list. And before you knew it, we were managing projects that were submitted by about 70 different organizations from around the region.
I understand that we're talking about 1,000 projects region-wide. Is that right?
Yeah, on our list, there's upwards to close to 1,100 projects throughout the six-county region.
I'm talking with Matt Mayhood of the Sacramento Metro Chamber of Commerce. This morning, many leaders in the Sacramento region announced a combined regional wish list for federal stimulus money. They included the mayors of Sacramento and West Sacramento, the president of Sacramento State, the head of Sacramento Regional Transit, and many others. The bills in the House and the Senate are very different from each other. Which bill do you prefer?
You know, what I would say to that is that the Sacramento Metro Chamber and our regional delegation are aligned when we say that we want the Congress and the Senate and the President to act quickly, but we also want them to act in a manner that is going to help create jobs and long-standing assets for this region and for our country. They don't have to necessarily act super fast. We want them to be effective and efficient, especially in the way that they get monies down to local jurisdictions to make sure that we can put that money to work and get people back to work as soon as possible.
You said the regional delegation is aligned. Is Republican Congressman Tom McClintock aligned with California Senator Barbara Boxer on this?
Well, we have been talking and communicating back and forth with our regional congressional delegation. I'm not saying our regional delegation is completely aligned, but I'm saying that the Metro Chamber, along with our local jurisdictional partners, are aligned in how we'd like to see the process move forward. And again, we would like them to move in an efficient, effective manner that creates jobs and gets money down to the local jurisdictions as soon as possible.
There's been very little Republican support in Congress for the two bills so far, and I've heard Republicans in Washington say that these are spending bills, not stimulus bills. What message would you send to Republican members of Congress who've voted against the bills?
Well, I think it's a difficult balance. There's a lot of challenges that both parties have with the stimulus package that's been presented, and they're trying to get to a compromise level. I think it's important that from the business community's perspective that we are in a crisis here and that we need to create jobs in the Sacramento region. The Sacramento region has a number of projects that are ready to be funded. We're very capable of completing projects on time and within budget. And, you know, the Sacramento community, we have a lot of major employers here that can put people to work, but we need some dollars to flow down to get some of these projects funded to put people back to work. So, you know, they need to strike a balance in D.C., but let's get the money down into, you know, the private sector where they can put people back to work.
Assuming that not all the projects are funded with the federal stimulus money, and it's hard to imagine that they could be, how are projects prioritized? And does your group of leaders, do they have any guidance to the federal government about how to prioritize all among these 1,000 region-wide projects?
Well, I think some projects are going to come down by formula. Probably transportation funding is the best example, where the money will flow down from the federal government, potentially through the state based on a funding, the parameters that they set forth. But it's hard for us to prioritize one project over another. Because there's so many projects, there's so many good projects, but we have to look at job readiness, how quickly those projects can get started, get them out to bid, and how many jobs they're going to create. And ultimately, in the end, what's the biggest impact? How many jobs are going to create, and what's the long-standing regional asset that they're going to create? And those are obviously going to go to the top of the list.
So your colleagues have not numbered these in descending order of priority?
No, we haven't numbered them in descending order. I mean, you have a lot of jurisdictions that have come together and said, you know, yeah, we recognize, you know, these transportation projects are most important to our region. These flood projects are most important to our region. These sewer projects are most important. And we've, you know, highlighted a couple of these projects in each of these categories on our website at metrochamber.org. /federal stimulus. You can see a list of some of these key projects that we're focused on.
Matt Mayhood, President and CEO of the Sacramento Metro Chamber of Commerce. We've been talking about the Sacramento region's concerted effort to try and get as much federal stimulus money as possible to about 1,000 infrastructure projects of various kinds in the Sacramento region. Matt Mayhood, thanks so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local poet wraps up a decades-long labor of love, his 8-volume translation of the poems of Pablo Neruda. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, is California actually finally getting close to a budget deal? Plus, a high-profile California business leader moves a step closer to running for high office. Meg Whitman, former CEO of eBay and a Republican, files papers to formally explore running for governor. Those stories and more are later today on All Things Considered. In 1984, local poet William O'Daly published his first book of translations of the poetry of Pablo Neruda. This year, he publishes his 8th and final volume of Neruda translations, so wrapping up a labor of love that's taken over 25 years and attracted national attention. William O'Daly, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Good to be back.
Did you really think when you started out that this was going to take decades and involve many, many books?
I certainly did not. It's often good that we don't know certain things. Innocence is terrific. But before the first book was published in 84, I had a pretty good idea I would do at least 2 more. I was interested in the late and posthumous work of Neruda, and this one book I had started only because it was an assignment for a class at Cal State Fresno. And so when I spent all those years getting my chops as a translator and revising and revising again what became Still Another Day, I further looked into the late books, and a couple more caught my attention and my imagination.
So was it a coincidence in a way that you were assigned Neruda to translate all those years ago?
Well, a coincidence in a sense. I had had one teacher at UC Santa Barbara a few years before that, Kenneth Rexroth, who said, if you want to be a poet, translate, translate, translate. And at Fresno, I was studying with Philip Levine, another wonderful American poet, and he said basically the same thing. He said, if you're going to be a poet, in order to get to increase your voice, the volume, but also the depth and sensibility of your voice, translate, get outside yourself.
Why translate? I mean, why not just write your own poetry?
Well, again, to get outside yourself, to expand your vision, to enter another culture and look back at your own, to see it differently, to get well into another language, to hear another language, and thus better hear your own. Also, as Kenneth Rexroth said, well, it's a civil service to the poetry world, and you get to hang out with a really high class of poet when you translate.
Like Pablo Neruda.
Like Pablo Neruda.
William O'Daly, poet, translator, fiction writer. World's End, his 8th and final volume of translations of poems by Pablo Neruda, has just been published. It's a culmination of O'Daly's decades-long project of translating all of Neruda's poetry. From World's End, there's a poem called The Passion, and you're going to read it for us.
Yes, I'd be happy
to. Anything we need to know before you start it?
Well, this is the first poem. We'll call it a poem. Actually, the whole book is a poem. It's a long poem, the second one that he wrote, only the second one. And it launches the book in about 100 different directions, and it comes right after the prologue, which is a little too long to read here. So this is a good place to start.
Okay.
The Passion. Today I have been entangled in a congress of shadows, and to my epic I must declare other unceasing roads, the transformation of the waves, the truthfulness of silence. I am only a number fallen from a tree that had no purpose, because it reached with its roots to the other side of the earth. My magnitude is my torment. I still don't have a name. I remember that in a city I fell asleep waiting for autumn. They found me beneath the snow, so frozen white, I remain there still, like a statue, motionless, with no direction. My truest vocation was to become a mill. Singing in the water, I studied the motives of transparency and learned from the abundant wheat the identity that repeats itself. And so I came to be what I am, the most parceled heart. It is known that your heart and what sustains it are not yours alone. We presume it's not necessary to keep kindness in one's pockets. Your sadness begets sadness. Your roof belongs to the wind. There is a chain that moors with invisible links the shadows of all bodies. So he who sells his shadow sells yours as well as his own.
That's The Passion from World's End, translated by William O'Daly, the original poem written by Pablo Neruda. When you're translating this poem and others like it, do you try and imagine what Neruda would have made of this translation if he could read it? Or is that really beside the point? He's written his poem and now it's Bill's turn to write a version of it.
Well, that does play in from time to time. And he had a certain concern about his poems being translated into English. First of all, he was very generous about that. And he would say, I think in a metaphorical sense, though some of his translators took him literally, don't just translate me, improve me. Well, I don't claim to have done that. But he was worried that English was a little too hard, a little too Germanic, and that Spanish would not, his Spanish, which is sometimes incantory, often soft and mellifluous, wouldn't translate well at times. And music was very important to him. But I think that what I've done is I've tried to keep that in mind. And what I used to do, especially as a younger translator, would be to read his poems in Spanish into a recorder and then play them back to myself so that the cadences and the sounds would get into my bones and I'd have a better chance of reproducing the music.
Well, I can easily imagine that the original Spanish is softer because Spanish is just a different sounding language than English. But still, this is very soft English, listening to it.
Well, I did my best to soften it up and to round the edges because it's not just part of the music. It's part of the connotations of the poem, the implications, and its net, actually, what it gathers.
And for poetry, it's very plain language.
He is deceptively simple. And throughout much of his career, especially after the first third of his career, he dedicated himself to speaking more directly and simply, and within that, connoting the world, recreating the world within his imagination, so that poetry wasn't an elite activity whatsoever. It was an activity that would appeal to the people and speak to them.
William O'Daly's latest book, a translation of poems by Pablo Neruda, is called World's End. It was just published. You're going to read something else for us here. Two stanzas, I guess, verses from The Rose of the Herbalist, which is part of World's End. These two stanzas, if that's the correct word, are Silence and Unity. Am I describing them correctly?
I wouldn't say they're stanzas, Jeffrey. This is very hard because you have the long poem and then you have 11 sections, 12 with the prologue. And then the poems, the sections have titles, and they look like individual poems, but they're extremely integrated and orchestrated with one another through about 150 pages in the main manuscript.
Yes.
So I would say these are poems within a poem within the poem.
Okay.
This is the first one, Silence, is a bit of a nod, among other things, to where he grew up in the forests of Temuco, southern Chile. Silence. I who grew inside a tree should have much to say, but I learned silence so well, I have a lot to keep quiet that is aware it is growing, with no other pleasure than growing, with no passion but substance, with no action but innocence, until within golden time the heights call it, so as to convert it into oranges.
And unity?
And this is just pure Neruda. This is like the little kernel at the core of who he was. All leaves are this leaf, all petals are this flower, in abundance a lie. For all fruit is the same, the trees are one, alone, and the earth a single flower.
Very nice. At risk of pulling apart a beautiful petal, how is that at the core of who Neruda was as a poet?
Well, and he saw... There are a lot of conversations that poets have about what poetry should do, what it should be, what it shouldn't do, and what it shouldn't be. And to Neruda, it was all one big, I used the word earlier, net. There was no subject, human subject, that was not in any way amenable to poetry. Poetry could address anything that was human. He also saw our fates as people utterly connected, as though we were all part of the same root system that spread over the earth. And so those are the two biggest or most crucial intrinsic ideas.
As well as being a poet who not incidentally won a Nobel Prize, Neruda also had a substantial career in politics and public service. He was an ambassador for Chile and he was a senator. And he was close to President Salvador Allende, who lost power, of course. How important was his political life to Neruda, or was that just a way to make money so that he could write poetry?
Oh, it's funny. If you go to the Freedom of Information Act and look up the FBI file on Neruda, the FBI at the time, and we're talking the 1940s onward, thought that his poetry was just a front for his politics. What became 3,000 pages and endless awards was just a front, which, of course, is utterly laughable. The politics of Neruda grew out of his poetry naturally. It grew out of his own commitments as a human being. And so there would be no reason for him not to address politics in his poetry because that was a human activity, one that he was involved in. And there are a number of things, including the execution of Federico Garcia Lorca by the Falangists in Spain, his close friend, just simply for going home to Valencia, that radicalized him. And then he saw in his own country González Videla, president who took over in 1946, turn against the people and create these concentration camps for miners who went on strike. And that's when he was sent into exile. And from that time on, poetry was woven in and out of his work until his death.
We're just about out of time, Bill, but maybe you can address this quickly. Neruda died just days after the coup by Augusto Pinochet that usurped President Allende. Did that play into Neruda's death, or was he going to die at that time anyway?
They say he died of a broken heart. And I believe that's partially true. He died in a clinic in Santiago with his friends coming to him. He was, by that time, a father, a grandfather figure of poetry and the culture. And they'd come and say, Pablo, they have just killed so-and-so. They've just killed Victor Jara. And this happened over and over until he went into a coma. He may have died anyway, but he had planned. The Mexican government was ready to fly him out.
Yes.
And he had been doing pretty well up until the 2 weeks prior.
We've been talking about World's End, the eighth and final volume of translations of poems by Pablo Neruda by local poet and translator and writer William O'Daly. It's a culmination of his decades-long project of translating Neruda's works. He gives a reading from the book this Sunday evening in Sacramento. It's at Time Tested Books. It starts at 7 o'clock. That's in Midtown Sacramento. William O'Daly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Enjoyed it.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Nathan Wilkinson, with much help from Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. A new book explores the lives of women in post-war Iraq. On the next Insight, the co-author of What Kind of Liberation, Women and the Occupation of Iraq tells you about the book. She speaks in Davos this week. Also, we follow up on last week's discussion of possible solutions to the mortgage crisis. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Capital Public Radio.